just to have a little fun. I just love it. That's just like, well, like for instance, Stephanie was telling me she liked my shoes. I got these when I was in San Antonio. And I said, Saks Fifth Avenue. Now, that's a big name to women, you know. You hear all that. I mean, how many of y'all been to Saks Fifth Avenue? You know, I'd never been to Saks Fifth Avenue. And so I saw that store, and I said, hot damn, I got to go in and look around. And so I went in there. Well, I can't afford to buy stuff in Saks Fifth Avenue. I know that, but it doesn't hurt to just have fun. And I'm in there looking, and I saw this pair of shoes, and I said, oh, be still my heart. And so I went over there, and all the salespersons in the Saks Fifth Avenue, they have on little black skirts and little white blouses and little black blazers, and they're very, very proper. And the lady came over, and she said, may I be of assistance? Not can I help you, but may I be of assistance? And I said, yes, I want to try on them. And she said, would you like for me to fit you? I said, no, just bring me a big 10. I said, 30 stems for to carry it around. And she... And so she went back, and she came back with the shoes, and I put them on, and here's what I did.
Yeah.
These are comfortable. And she was just like stunned, you know. But then you could see there was a little twinkle that started, you know, in her eye, and it's like, she's having fun. I wish I could, but we've got to maintain this little thing, you know. And so then I had this little thing that said, we're going to crack her up if we can. And so... And so I went tearing across the carpet over to the floor area, you know, where you get off the carpet, you got to see. Shoes feel good on carpet that don't feel good on a hard floor. And so I went over there and did another little dance, and she went like that, you know. And so I went back over there, and I said, I'll take them. And there are no cash registers in Saks Fifth Avenue that you can see. They take everything behind the scenes and do it, you know. And they come back, and she said, have a good day. I have a feeling you do a lot of that. And I said, I sure do, and I have a good time. I said, I'm going to go down to the DQ. I saw one of those here in the mall, and I'm going to have me a blizzard. And she said, that sounds real good. She said, I like Sundays. I said, would you like a Sunday? And I took that sales girl back a Sunday. See, I can have fun, and I can play. Where before, I was so intense about stuff that would never occur to me to have fun. You had to act right. You had to act right, you know. And that's like with Itchy Bitchy. We were at the grocery store. And I'm going over, but I've got to tell you this story, and then I'll quit. We were at the grocery store, and Teresa's a little bitty woman, and she had hurt herself, and she was having a hard time getting around that day, and her legs was bothering her, and I said, why don't you ride in the cart? And I said... Well, you won't fit in them little slots at the top, but I said, what you can do is, she said, she got on the front of the cart, she put her feet on the part, and she leaned over. Well, this caused a real off-balance situation, so I had to really bear down on my end of the cart with the handle to keep from being flipped over, you know. And I'm going through all this, and I'm zipping up and down the aisles, and I'm saying, coming up on the left! Reach out, get chips now. And she'd take her arm and reach out and grab a bag. And we'd just go on. She'd throw it in the car and say, passing so-and-so. You know, and there was some kids there. They looked like they might have been 8 or 10 years old. One little boy looked down and said, we'd get a whipping if we did that. And I said, and you should. And just kept on. Thank you. Something a little different. This is going to be on the promises. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells us that the spiritual life is not a theory, we have to live it. That's basically what it's saying. And in its broadest sense, spirituality means a breath of life. And that's where we come in here. And we hear about promises. Now, when I came into Al-Anon, I grew up on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and no one told me that I couldn't have promises. I've heard a lot of groups say, well, we can't have those promises in Al-Anon because, you see, those are for the alcoholics. That's in their book. And then nowhere in our Al-Anon literature do you find anything called the promises. It's interesting because in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says if you've been painstaking about this work up to this point, certain things will begin to happen. And it doesn't say if you're an alcoholic who's working the steps, this will come to happen. It just says if you're doing the work, this will happen. So I like to, I'm the kind of person, I'm greedy. I don't want to miss anything. And so I thought, well, how could it be that only an alcoholic would get the promises? And I thought, bullshit, you know? That doesn't seem fair, you know. It just doesn't seem fair. And I said, well, I think I'm going to start claiming some of them dudes for myself. It's important to me to realize that it's where it is mentioned, what we term as the promises, on page 83 and 84 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, your handout, I've gone through there to show you just a few of some of the other promises that are found in the book that are not listed as so-called the 12 promises. But some of these are just as vitally important to me as any of the other 12. And I wanted to share with you today a little bit about each one of these promises, and if we have time, we'll go through some of those in the handout, too. We'll have to sort of see how we go here. Like I say, I've never done it before, so I don't know time-wise what we're talking about. If we're still here at 9 o'clock tonight and you feel like you want to go, feel free to do so. Well, these are listed in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It comes between the 9th and 10th step. And I think that's really important because when we're working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon in our lives, the first several steps are dedicated to finding out who we are and our relationship to a higher power, and then getting ourselves all right with that power in steps 4 or 5, and then making changes in our life in 6 and 7 so that we're going to be useful members of society. And then we have to become responsible for all the wreckage that we have caused in our past. You know, our part of those things, and that's where 8 and 9 comes about. And then as you begin to do some of these things, as you work those previous 9 steps, you will find that gradually some of these things will begin to come true in your life. And I think many times things were happening in my life and coming true in my life without me actually identifying them as such. And then when I would read them, I'd say, yeah, that happened over here, or yeah, that's happening, or boy, I'd like that one over there, you know. I think the one that stood out to me the most was the one about economic insecurity, you know, the fear of that go away. It doesn't say you're going to be economically secure. I want to point that one out, you know, but the fear of it's going to go away. You know, you'll learn how to live with that crap, you know, that's what it meant. But what we're going to try to do with the promises to me and in the book is we're building a bridge between hope and faith. In other words, between our head and our hearts. And we have to have something to hold on to. And to me, the word promise has a big connotation to it. I don't know about y'all. But now, like for instance, between J.D. and I, we would have a lot of problems. And he would do something that would really hurt my feelings. I'd tell him about it and he'd say, honey, I promise you I'll never do that again. Yeah, might as well laugh. You're right. Uh-huh. And then he would do it again. And then I was twice as hurt because he had broken the promise in addition to doing the deed. And because with that promise, it was like I saw Moses come off of the mountain with the tablets. And it went, ka-chung, and there's the promise right across the tablet, you know. And it was like it's written in stone, and by God, it's going to come to pass. And I put all my hopes into that promise. So you have to realize that promises are on a spiritual nature. Promises are God-given. God can keep his promises. We as human beings don't always keep our promises. And so J.D. and I found for us, we don't use the word promise between us. And I promise I'll do this or I promise I'll do that. We say, I'll try. God willing, I'll try. I'm going to do my best. But I found for me that the word promise meant a lot, and it means a lot in this book because these are spiritual truths. They're not just a promise. It's a spiritual truth that if you do certain things, then these things will come true for you. The paragraph which some people miss right after where the promises are listed, it says, are these promises extravagant? We think not. They are being achieved among us, some slowly, some more quickly. But it says they will always materialize if you're willing to work for them. And I think that's where the problem comes. A lot of times we're very spiritually lazy people, and we don't want to be willing to work for that promise to come true in our life. Because that working means that we're going to have to give up some of our old ideas and attitudes on a lot of this. I had to begin to do some different things in my life for these promises to take place. I can tell you there were certain things that I could promise you about. If you continue to do what you've always done, I promise you, you'll get what you've always got. Only it'll be worse. It'll be worse. You know, they say, you know, things can get better or things can get worse. Well, if you don't do it, things will get worse. Trust me on that. Because if you're like me, every time you make that mistake again and again, you have a tendency to beat yourself more and more and more. And you go down. So I'm going to try to share with you today some of the promises and how they have come true in my life. Promise number one is we're going to know our new freedom and a new happiness. Now, freedom is not what I used to think it was. Back in the 60s and 70s, I thought freedom was if it feels good, do it. Now, on your page here, it's the ones on page 83 and 84 on your handout. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. Like I say, I grew up in this, if it feels good, do it. Well, that's not real freedom. I mean, that's sort of infringing yourself on other people, you know. I had to learn that if it feels good and it doesn't hurt anybody else, especially me, then I might consider it. You know, I've had to learn to modify that viewpoint. But if you continue on in that type of thought, if it feels good, do it, it's sort of like going to sleep with dogs. Ultimately, you're going to wake up fleas. you know, things are going to happen. You know, you can't just do everything you feel, because remember, feelings aren't facts. Feelings are very changeable. And that's like when my husband would say to me, you know, just tell me what I need to do to make you happy. Well, let's see, what time is it today? Well, at 1:26, let's see, what would make me happy on a Saturday? You know, because at 1:27, it might be something different, because I didn't know what it was that I needed to make me happy, so I didn't have any idea what it was. But obedience to God's will is what brings me into the state of freedom and happiness. You know, it's like when I'm doing my own self-will, everything is pretty limited, and I'm doomed to failure. But when I am operating out of God's will, then I have a whole broad area of possibilities open to me. And part of that is, you know, it's like the closer I stay to my higher power, the more I'm able to experience freedom and happiness. Because then I'm not afraid of what you're going to say, and what you're going to think about me, what's going to happen over here, because I am staying close to God. And when I'm staying close to God, there's nothing going to happen to me that God can't take care of. And once I know that deep inside of me, then this promise begins to take a real meaning in my life. You know, and you think in terms of a wolf. A wolf doesn't, if you've got a bunch of sheep, a wolf does not bother the sheep that's with the flock. It goes on those that are over there doing their own thing. Those little sheep that are out there wandering around out by themselves, that's the ones that the wolves and the coyotes pick off, because they know they're vulnerable. And those that are close to the shepherd over here are the ones that are going to be protected the most, you know. So if I think on that in terms of, if I'm doing what I need to be, if I'm staying close to God and my people, which is y'all, I'm going to be less likely to be out there and walk a walk of land and able to get hurt, you know. I'm not as vulnerable, let us say. Now, everybody would like to be successful and happy, and a lot of times I thought success was happiness. You know, happiness was when. Happiness is when I get, when I have, when you do. It was out there. It never occurred to me that happiness had to start from inside, and that happiness was a decision. You know? It's like, have a good day unless you've made other plans. Well, now, I have consciously woke up on days and decided to be miserable. I don't know about y'all, but when I get up and I make a conscious decision that, you know, oh, man, I don't want to get up, and I start that whining attitude in my head, I have made myself a drag for the day. It's really that simple. I have to sometimes do some things I don't want to do. I have to make some changes if I'm going to find freedom and happiness. Like, I'm going to have to change playgrounds and playmates. I used to think happiness was excitement and living on the edge. I still like excitement, but I find more positive excitement in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, and I don't have to go to the bars and find it anymore. You know, I mean, there's a difference. I had to change where I go and what I do and who I associate with, and I cannot be around people who are negative but for measured doses of time, because I'm a joiner in. I don't know about you, but have you ever been around somebody that just sits there and bitches and complains and everything is woe and gloom, and what do you find yourself doing? God, yeah, I know what you're talking about. Let me tell you about mine. You know, I would go to meetings sometime, and I would feel great. And I'd get in there and listen to some newcomer whining and pissing and moaning about stuff, you know, and I'd get there, and I'd think, yeah, boy, I remember when J.D. did so. How dare he do that? I'd go home and tell him, I'll slap shit out of you. Because I'm a joiner in, you know. I join in, and I join in on feelings, you know. We call it empathizing, you know. But the bottom line was, there's a difference between sympathy and empathy and being well. There's a difference between all those things. And I found, like, there's certain people in my life that I had to take in measured doses, and my mother was one of them. Because my mother, nothing good ever happened to her. She'd call, and she'd start telling me what a terrible day she'd had and what all was going wrong. And I said, Mama, tell me something good happened today. And she'd say, don't be snotty. You know. She didn't know. And so what I had to do was, a lot of times when Mama would call, I'd say, Mama, hang on. And I said, I got to go to the bathroom. And I'd lay the phone down, and I'd go to the bathroom, and I'd sit down on top of that commode seat, and I'd say, God, it's her again. And she's getting to me. And I need some positive reinforcement here, because I couldn't be around her that long or even on the phone with her that long. And sometimes I'd just have to say, Mama, I'm sorry. I got something I got to do. And what I had to do was get off the phone. I didn't need to have to hurt her feelings and tell her, you know, you're really driving me nuts. But the bottom line was, it's called self-protection. And I had the freedom to do that. You know, before I thought I was bound to have to be around people that I couldn't stand to be around. You know, it's like family functions. Aren't we coming up to a good time of year? God, don't we love holidays? We have a Thursday night meeting. People say, y'all meet on Thanksgiving? I said, yeah, we're so damn grateful there's a place to go when you've been with a family that... Man, if you can just live to get to your meeting and survive that holiday, I'm telling you, you know. And it used to feel that way, you know, and it can still happen that way. You know, sometimes you just hang on till you can get there, for God's sake, you know. But we have the freedom to tell somebody that. You see, I had the guilt feelings. If I told you how I felt about my mother, you'd think I was a bad person. And yet you can go into a meeting and you can tell somebody how you feel, and they know that that's a feeling, it's not a fact, and just because you have a bad feeling doesn't make you a bad person. So we have the freedom to share. There's a tremendous amount of freedom when someone gives you permission to share your feelings, tremendous amount. Where is your God? You know, I used to keep God in a box. I don't know about y'all. Do you ever keep God in a box? That's where it's what you just allow him to work in this area of your life, and I'll handle this one over here. I thank you. I know how to do my job. I don't need God on the job. Thank you very much. And then you get to work, and the person next to you does something that just drives you nuts, and then all of a sudden you realize, well, they got to work. Oh, what a bummer. You know, I took God with me on the highways, and y'all better be grateful. I could leave the house in a good mood. By the time I got to work, I was a raving ass nut. You know, there's people out there driving that don't need a license. Did you know that? And you know why they're out there? Because you're running late. You ever seen it fail? You're running late, and every slow turkey in the world pulls in front of you and squats, right? And did you know something? It's not them that's out of sync. It's you. If you had got up at the time you were supposed to get up and left when you would, you'd have missed them. They're always out there, same time. You're the one that's out of sync, you know. You're the one that's out of sync. And then you expect them to do something different. Little insanity there. It's called accepting life on life's terms, taking God out of that box and taking him with you in every area of your life, not limiting God's power to only work here, there, and whatever. You know, my higher power is a real gentleman, and he doesn't go where he's not invited, you know? And I didn't realize that I could take him and use him in each and every. And the more that I begin to use God, the more conscious I became of God working in my life, the more freedom I had, the more independence I had, and the happier I was, you know? Another thing about happiness, you can be right or you can be happy. See, I like being right. And in order for me to be right, you know what that means. You got to be wrong. I'm even happier when you're wrong and you know it. And if you don't, I'll tell you about it. Isn't that stupid? But that's what I used to do. I used to go around, and when I'd win the argument, think yes. And I didn't win nothing. You don't win in an argument, for God's sake. All they do is just shut up because they're tired of fighting. And I'll admit is I just hang in there a long time. You know, I had stability, you know. I was consistent. I could consistently drive you nuts on any given thing, you know. I'd hang in because I know from experience if you hang in long enough, you get your way. I've done it all my life. You scream and holler about it and whine about it long enough. Everybody finally goes, I've seen little kids do that in airports. You ever notice that? They're banned kids from airports. And they always sit by me, behind me, or in front of me. I've never seen it fail. You know, the one that wants to scream for 5,000 miles, that's the one I get next to, you know. And all he's wanting is his way. That's all he's wanting is his way. And that was all I was wanting. But when I begin to give up and do it a different way, by doing it the way that God would have me to do it, things begin to be better in my life. It's just amazing. And some of the freedom I had was freedom from fears. Now, I don't know about you, but I was eat up with fear. I didn't know I was such a fearful person. I had no idea that my life ran on fear. I would have told you that I was not afraid of anything. You know, I'm a pretty big girl. I mean, you know, there's just not too much to be afraid of. But I didn't like being at home in the dark by myself. I didn't like flying for years. Didn't like flying. Scared to death of heights. You know, it's just not a pleasant thing to look at the Grand Canyon on your belly like a snake. You know, you drive all that distance, you get over there, and then you get out of the car and you crawl the last, you know, 100 yards. And you look over and say, yeah, it looks good. Back up. That's pitiful. You're not free when you've got those kind of unnatural fears. There's no freedom in life to that. Do you realize there's a lot of things in God's world out there that you will never be able to enjoy if you are bound up in those kind of fears? And I didn't know that. I am not afraid of buttons and buzzers. I have the freedom to accept help from others. I used to couldn't do that. I couldn't accept your help because it made me feel less than to have to be dependent upon you. I was scared to death that there was something going to happen and you couldn't meet my needs. And there very well may be, but there's nothing that's going to happen that God can't, and God uses people. I call it God with skin on it. A lot of times God puts those people in my life to do for me the things that I need to have done that I can't do. A few years ago I had a heat stroke. And it was a real scary thing, you know. I was standing here talking like to a group of people, and all of a sudden, I don't know if you've ever put a jigsaw puzzle together, you know, all those little weird-shaped pieces. That's the way people begin to look. They begin to just sort of separate into little weird shapes and things. It was real freaky. You're standing up here, you know, and you're trying to do something, and you go, oh, something is happening. Maybe it will go away. A little denial of reality. But as a result, I had a certain regimen that I had to adopt for my life if I was going to continue to live one. And part of that was I was going to have to go, and everything in my body had gone completely to pluck out of balance. And the doctor said that I would get more in balance, get all of my little electrolytes and crap done if I'd do some exercise. Well, I mean, that's sort of like the big E, you know, exercise, E. You know, thank you very much. This is it, man. I can do this. And he said, no, he said, I want you to get off that fat butt of yours, and I want you to walk. And he said, go over to the mall where there's air conditioning. He said, you can't do the heat. You'll never be able to do the heat anymore, and you just have to accept that. And I said, but wait a minute, I want to do that. He said, no, you're going to have to live first. And so all of a sudden, I felt one of my freedoms leave me, I thought, because I didn't have the freedom to come and go and do as I pleased anymore because I had some limitations there. And not only that, I said, but how am I even going to get, if I can't do heat, how can I get to the mall? Because the air conditioner's out on my car. And he said, well, fix it. And I said, oh, I can't afford to do that. I said, the air conditioner's worth more than the car. And he said, well, why don't you ask somebody to take you? Novel idea. Because, see, I'm the person other people call and ask to help them. I am not the person who calls and asks other people to help me. You know, it's okay. And you know why? Because when you're the giver, you're in control. You're in control of who you give to, when you give to, how much you give to, when you don't. If you're the receiver, you're vulnerable because you're at that other person's whim. I don't like that. I like to be the giver. Thank you very much. And I had to go, and I told, and like I say, thank God I have a big sponsorship family. And so I said, your assignment is to take Mother to the mall. And they looked, and I said, no, in all seriousness, I just got them again. I said, I need some help with transportation to the mall to walk, and I'll walk and then come back home. I need the transportation back and forth. And I said, and like to the meetings, I said, because I can't afford to get the air conditioner fixed. They wanted $800 to fix the air conditioner on my car. And I said, that's just the reality here. I've got to do this deal. And they said, we are more than happy to help you, my God. You know, we wonder, you know, what can we do to help you? And then here it is, you know, and then here I've been depriving them of that. And did you know that made me feel more free than I've ever felt? Because now I have the freedom to say, I have a need that I can't take care of. Can you help me? And there's great freedom in being able to do that instead of having to do it for yourself all the time. Tremendous freedom there. Giving and receiving for free. For free. And not keeping score of what I give you. And not keeping score of what you give me. Learning to accept was one of the hardest things, to receive. And thing of it is, I'd think, well, God, I really hate to call them because, you know, I know they've got a lot to do, and I know they've got, and I'd sit there and I'd think, and yeah, that's just what some people tell you when you're sponsoring them is, I didn't want to bother you because I knew you were busy, ta-da-ta-da, and you know you're sitting there and you're not that busy, you can do that deal. And so I had to put myself on the other side of that coin. And it was hard to do. You know, it bends your ego a little to have to do that when you can't be self-supporting totally like you'd like to be. And then, like I said, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? You know, it never occurred to me that that was a choice I was making. That's a choice. Happiness is a choice. I can decide to be or not to be. It's up to me. My great-grand sponsor told me that every morning when she gets up, she goes to her kitchen window and she looks out and she says these words, today's the day that God has made and I'm going to make a decision right now to have a good day. I'm going to be happy today. And I thought, God, you know, you mean you just make a decision? You just do that? And see, I didn't realize that I made those decisions sometimes. Like, for instance, when I'd open my eyes in the morning and I would look at him and wonder what kind of day we were going to have. In that split second, I had turned my will and my life over to him and what he did for the day. not a higher power, but I had made him a higher power because he was in control of how my day was going to be. And when I say that to myself out loud, this is the day that God has made, and I'm going to do the best I can, and I'm going to be as happy as I possibly can be today. And I hear myself say that. It makes a difference in your mind. Now, I did this one year at Christmas time. Christmas holidays were always bummers for me, especially during the active drinking, because you could always depend on extra jail terms and the Christmas money going to get him out of jail. And, you know, so I told him, get in jail today, see how quick you come out. I'm a little more well now. You know, try that again. But these were all choices that I made. But that morning I got up and I said to myself that it's Christmas holidays and they're usually hard times and I have a lot of old memories that were hard to... Old tapes are really hard to get rid of. It took a number of years to be able to put some of those things back there and not bring them out and agonize them. The things that happened are still there and I can share those things without bringing back the feelings and getting mad at him again or feeling sorry for myself again. It's just like reading a history book. This is old history and this is what happened. Don't have any feeling about it today one way or the other. But that particular morning I got up and I said, I'm going to be happy today. It's in the damn holidays, but I'm going to be happy today. I'll tell you, I'm going to be happy today. And ain't nobody going to ruin my happiness today. And so that evening we had gone over to his mother's to take some Christmas presents. His mother had a real long driveway. Real long driveway. And J.D. was tired, and he had said to me, honey, why don't you drive tonight? So I was driving, and I was going down that long driveway, and I can go just zipping down that long driveway. Now, the problem is I can zippy forward down that long driveway, but I don't zippy backward too well up that driveway. And it had been raining real hard for days. And the ground was soft. And his mom and dad wasn't home. And he said, well, we'll go and we'll come back later. And so that meant I was going to have to back up that long driveway. Well, I ain't going to tell him I can't back up that long driveway. I mean, he ought to know. He's been around me long enough. He ought to know I can't do that very well. But I'm going to give it a try. And naturally, I got off the driveway and sunk the axle right up, man, just in the mud. Just went right up in that yard, you know, and I, oh, shit. Now, you know, have you ever noticed how the other person acts like you did something to be proud about? I mean, like you're sitting there going, look what I did, look what I did, you know. He looked at me and he said, that's the dumbest, stupidest thing I've ever seen. Who ever told you you could drive a car? Why in the hell do you have a license? And he went into all this terrible thing, you know, telling me how rotten a driver I was, and he called me everything but a human being. And I got out of the car, and I went around, and I looked at that axle, and it was still in the mud. And I went back, and I said, well, that didn't help at all. You want to try something useful like calling a wrecker now? Now, what I realized later was I was using a sense of humor with the situation. I didn't take everything he said to heart and think that I was bad and I wasn't a good person just because I made a mistake driving backwards, you know? I wasn't meant to drive backwards. What's behind me is not important. So, I mean, I've run over a few things in the back. Not a big deal. Don't get behind my car. What can I tell you? But the bottom line was I had made a decision to be happy that morning. And it didn't ruin my day. It didn't ruin my Christmas. It didn't ruin my night. We called a wrecker. They came. They pulled the thing out. We told them Merry Christmas with a check, and we went on back home. You know, it wasn't that I was taking my grocery money to pay for the wrecker. I wouldn't. And we got home, and we were laughing about it. And he said, I never felt so stupid in my life. And you asked me, well, that didn't work. You want to do something that works, like call a wrecker? And he said, why do you sit there and why do you beat yourself for something or someone else when that doesn't change the situation at all? Not at all. You don't know. Who knows? Number two, we'll not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. Did you know that there's nothing in the world that I can do or have done that will stop God from loving me? Absolutely nothing. But the problems always lie within me as to why I do what I do. It's not your fault why I do what I do. A lot of times we like to blame you. But there's no hope if I blame you because I can't change anything you're doing. But if I can change what I'm doing, then there's hope for me. I don't have to be a victim. And I think that's one of the greatest things I learned in here is that we're victims. We're not victims. Excuse me. We are not victims. We volunteer. You know? We keep going back for that same thing time and time again. We volunteer for that crap. But after I did my fourth and fifth step and went through that, I found that that had a tendency to remove a lot of that garbage from the past away. It separated me, and I saw that I may have done bad things, but I wasn't a bad person. When you're doing a fourth and fifth step, I think you do it to find out what's the truth. what is the truth about me? Because we have a tendency to minimize the things we should be looking at and maximize the bullshit that we shouldn't be caring that much about, you know? And I found out what was the good, what was the bad, what was the ugly, what was the this. But basically, I found out what was the truth about myself. Now, God will remove in the sixth and seventh step anything that you allow him to remove that stands between you and the usefulness to your fellow man and to God. He'll do those things for you. And that is why that the past is an asset. We don't have to regret the past anymore. You know, I don't regret what I've done because it took everything I did to get me where I am here. You know, that's like I thought for a long time I'd sit in the rooms of Al-Anon and I'd say, God, I wish I'd have found this program while J.D. was still drinking. It wouldn't have made any difference. I wouldn't have done it. Because I wasn't through doing everything I was going to try to do. I never give up until I have done everything humanly possible. One of the girls I have has a shirt that says, every time I ever let go of anything, it had claw marks all over it. You know, and that's it, from hanging on, you know, from hanging on. And so and when you share your past, it frees other people. That's the reason the past, not regret the past, nor wish to share, to shut the door on it. Another thing, if I shut the door on the past, it's liable to repeat itself. That's where my experience comes from, in knowing what the past, what my past behavior, when you do this, this happens. When you don't do this, this happens. And if you have shut the door on that, you're going to have to learn that lesson again and again and again and again because you're trying to pretend it didn't happen. And I can remember sitting there thinking, surely I didn't do that. Surely to God, I didn't do that. No, you didn't do that. No, you just thought it looked that way. It wasn't really that bad. No. Nah, not a big deal. And guess what? You find yourself doing it again down the road because you have changed all that. You have justified. You have rationalized it. But you haven't done anything to change it. So I have to look at the past. You know, it can be the great one of our greatest assets is your past because that's your experience. And what do we share best? Experience, strength, and hope. You know? It's sort of like my sponsor told me. She says, like looking in a rearview mirror in the car. She said, you have to look up occasionally to make sure you're not being creamed, you know, from behind. You know, there's a purpose in looking in the rearview mirror to check where everything's okay. But if you look only in the rearview mirror, you run over what's right in front of you. So you use it as an occasional glance, just sort of as a touch base to check, as a check of where am I right now, right here. Working step none is real dangerous. You know? When you're doing the old things you used to do, but see, by having the past, I know my pattern. And my pattern is a lot of times I discuss things with me. Now, that's real scary. Because when I discuss things with me, I don't have any other input than the nut. And what you hear in your head makes sense most of the time. You ever notice that? No matter how crazy it is, when it's up here, it makes sense. And see, I have a committee that comes in to visit. And we'll sit around and we'll have a little coffee clutch up there in my head, you know, and we'll discuss things. Now, see, knowing that about me, I know it's real important that I go and talk to someone and get that out of my head where I can hear what it really sounds like. Because up here, it's always good. But when you hear it, a lot of times you go, that is nuts. Absolutely nuts. But it made such good sense up here. Shutting the door on the past would be keeping those secrets behind closed doors again. And I was told I was only as sick as the secrets. You know, the things that you do are not as important as how you feel about you because of the things that you did. You know, a lot of things that I did were not that bad, but I felt really bad about me because I'd done them. And so that's another reason that you need to remember, and it helps keep a perspective. I think that's the main thing about that. It helps you to keep a perspective. And you don't have to go around thinking, this time it'll be different. Because if your past has taught you anything, it's taught you it's not going to be any different. We will comprehend the word serenity. Anybody know what to do with serenity when you had it? I tell you what, it was amazing to me when I'd get a little serenity going in our home. I was so used to chaos that I'd have to create a disaster of some kind to keep that comfortability feeling going. Everything's in a mess, the situation normal, all screwed up, you know. True and enduring serenity is found at the point when one realizes and accepts its own limitations. That's when you're in a You're in a point of acceptance. When you can accept yourself and what's going on It's just the way it needs to be right here, right now, and it won't be forever. Nothing is forever. It wasn't this way last 6 months ago, and it won't be this way 6 months. And my sponsor proved this to me one time. She had me to write down 10 things that were driving me nuts. And I said, just 10? Because, see, when everything's a big deal, nothing's a big deal. But everything was a big deal to me, you know. So I was always scattered, focusing on everything in general. And I wrote those 10 things down, and she gave it to me, and she said, now I'll take and put them in this envelope. And she said, I want you to put them in your ODAT book, like maybe 2 or 3 months further down. And she said, you don't want to look at it, but until you get there. And you know, when I got there, I opened up my envelope, and every one of those things were gone. None of those things were still the major disaster of the day, and I had 10 more to put in the little thing. You know, and I'd keep doing that for a while. But what that proved to me was that things change, situation change, and nothing is forever. And once you could accept that, it says, grant me the serenity to accept that things are just the way they are. You know, accept the reality of life. A lot of times we procrastinate, and we try to get around that, you know. We don't want to do this deal. We don't want to be, and a lot of times serenity is real uncomfortable. We have meetings every once in a while on serenity, how to stand it. You know, that'll be the meeting topic, you know. How do you stand serenity? How do you enjoy serenity enough not to screw it up? How can you do that? A lot of people are sitting around going, God, everything's so great in my life. I wonder when the next thing's going to happen. And you ruin your serenity right then by worrying about what's going to happen and how long it's going to last or what happens. You don't have to do it that way. Remember, though, true serenity is not freedom from the storm, but having peace in the middle of it. And I didn't understand that. I said, that doesn't make any sense at all. But I have had this, and I've experienced this in my life. I was in the middle of a tornado, and I was okay. I was just pissed off about getting wet. I didn't even realize the seriousness of the situation. I was in a state of peace. I wasn't terrified of the tornado anymore. Therefore, I could be in a storm and not automatically think tornado, you know. And the amazing thing was that when I was quivering in the closet, scared to death of the tornado, and when I was out in the car in the middle of the tornado, not afraid, God was both places. It didn't make any difference where I was. God was taking care of me. And I was the one that was putting the nerving fit on myself. You know, I've always terrified myself by feeding my fears. You know, have you ever noticed how fears are real social? They don't like to be alone. Have you ever been just afraid of one thing? One fear calls to another fear calls to another fear. You get a whole gang of fears going, you know. That's what it does for me, is I get all these fears. You know, it's like when J.D. had cancer. J.D., I'd been sober, and all of a sudden we noticed that there was this thing on his head that had begun to grow, and he was afraid to go get it seen about because all the men in his family had died of cancer and before they were 60, and so he was terrified. And true enough, if you've got a history of cancer, there is a high probability that you'll have cancer. So he finally went to the doctor, and the doctor told him, the minute he looked at it, that he said, boy, you got a malignancy there. That's real nice, you know, they don't even have to do anything and just look at you and tell. And we got real scared, you know, got real scared. And we wouldn't talk about it, because, see, that's what we do when we get scared. We don't have a tendency to talk, because, see, if you talk, it makes it more real, and you don't want it to be, so therefore you don't talk about it. Maybe it'll go away if you just don't talk about it. Unfortunately, it didn't go away. But anyway, I got real terrified about it, and I couldn't talk to him about it, and I wanted to scream at him, I'm real mad at you for having this, because I'm afraid you're going to die. And I knew that he didn't need to hear, I'm afraid you're going to die, because he had enough of that himself. So one of the girls in the group called me that night, and I wasn't telling anybody about it. I'd mentioned it to my sponsor, but I wasn't telling anybody else. And that was that secret. That was that secret I was holding inside of me, and it was robbing me of all my peace. And she said, what's the matter with you? And I said, I don't know. I said, I can't talk about it. And so she got off the phone, and she called everybody in the group. Back then, there's about 12 or 15 of us. And she said, there's something wrong with Murph. Let's all pray for her. Now, I can't tell you what happened that night, but somewhere between midnight and 3 o'clock in the morning, I had peace and serenity come over me. The kind you can't understand, because, see, nothing had changed. There wasn't any need for peace to be there, but it was a knowing on the inside that everything was going to be okay. You don't know how it's going to work out, but you just know it's going to be okay no matter what happens. And that was serenity for me. That was one of the first times I experienced it. Serenity is when also I don't have to fight with someone, and I can allow them to be miserable without me being miserable. You know, used to I thought that if I loved you and cared about you, if you were having a bad day, I had one with you. You know, I mean, that was called love, you know. And J.D. did it to me first. I didn't like it when it was done to me, but it was a lot of fun doing it back. I got up one morning, I was griping and carrying on and what have you, and J.D. said to me, you know, he said, I'm sorry you're having a bad day, but I'm going to have a good one anyway. I feel real peaceful. Bye. That made me worse, you know, because I thought, if you loved me, if you loved me, you'd feel miserable with me. And so a few days after that, we got up one morning, J.D. was pissing and moaning, and I said, I'm in a state of serenity. I said, I'm sorry you're having a bad day, but I'm going to have a good one. And he just looked at me and I said, payback's a mother, ain't it? I tell you, I love it. But the thing about it is, in all truth, serenity for me is when you can be upset and I can recognize that you're upset and know that I'm powerless over it, and the best thing I can do for you is pray for you and then let God take care of it. And then I don't have to carry it as my burden on my heart anymore, because it doesn't do me any good to carry it because I can't do anything with it. Now, if carrying somebody else's problems and feelings help them, I'd say, let's do it. Let's do it. But it doesn't help them. And so I try not to do that anymore. And as a result, I have more serenity. It says, we will know peace. Now, peace is not normally achieved by frantic activity. I thought it was. Peace of mind always eluded me because I was always full of tension. I'm the kind of person, when the doctor asks me, he says, is there any kind of stress you're under? I said, no! Just a little uptight, you know. And he says, well, there's something that's elevating your blood pressure, you know. I mean, I was like a wire about to snap all the time. I was wrapped so tight. I was intense about everything. I never felt anything a little bit. I never was a little bit uncomfortable about anything. I was major whatever. I never dealt in terms of normalcy. I was always exaggerated. And did you know, even your health, your health cannot be gained by concentrating on your body. Do you know that? Hypochondriacs do it all the time. They concentrate on every little heartbeat. Did my heart beat 3 times that second, or was it 25? You know, I have one that'll say, I know I'm going to go into a panic attack tonight. I mean, she's into panic attack predicting. I guess it's all like the Richter scale, you know. You know, she says, I'll lay down that bed, and then my heart will go 100 miles an hour, and it'll feel like it's jumping out of my chest. And I said, well, call me. And so she called me, and she says, my heart's going 100 miles an hour. It's being out of my chest. I said, you're going to live. Hung up. And she told me later, she said, that was cruel. That was really cruel. And I said, you lived, didn't you? And she said, yeah, but I didn't. I said, I told you. You were going to live. I gave you permission to live. That's all you need. You know? She said, I won't call you the next time in one of those. I'll tell you that. And I said, good. Because I said, there's nothing I can do about it. But you know, the funny thing about it is she will call, and she'll say, it's starting to do that again. And I'll say, well, it's not going to kill you. You're not going to die from it. I said, you've had it checked over and over and over. You're pushing yourself into it. Now tell me what's going on. And you know, the funny thing is, by the time she gets through telling me what's going on, she doesn't have the panic attack. You know, wish she can have a little peace. I think my addiction to excitement kept me from experiencing peace. I didn't know how to accept peace or serenity, either one. I didn't know how to do that. I was always being controlled by something else, and I was so intense about things. And I would say I'd taken the third step, but then my actions would tell you I had not taken the third step. I've let go and let God. You know, you don't act and do the things that I did when you were in a state of peace. You just couldn't. And I can tell you one of the basic reasons. A person who is not at peace will not allow anybody else to have any either. Misery loves company. Have you ever noticed there's people that come around you and they'll tell you how wonderful and how peaceful everything is, but they're constantly stirring up shit like, did you know so-and-so said this about you? Did you know this was over here about you? That person's not at peace within themselves, because if they are, they don't find it necessary to have to do those things. So that's neat. God is the only consistent thing in my life. And when I am close to God, I have the peace. I can be alone and be okay. I can be peaceful at home. Used to, I had to have the TV going. I had to have the radio on. I had to have some kind of, be on the telephone. I couldn't be alone. Because if I was alone, I was alone with me. And I was alone with all that crap in my head that drove me nuts. So I did things to keep that crap, you know, it was louder than, so that I didn't have to focus on it. When I got the crap out, in doing steps 4, 5, 6, and 7, and taking care of it in 8 and 9, I could lay down and I didn't have to do that. I could be at peace. And I also found out that when I found God, I found me. and I could be at peace with me because I could talk to God and I could be at peace. I didn't have to worry anymore. You know, I used to think it was your duty to worry about people. And I think I learned that. My mother would say, you know, I'm worried about you. That means I love you. You know, and I didn't. And then so mother would call me and tell me something terrible, and I'd say, okay. And she'd say, well, aren't you worried about me? And I'd say, no. She'd say, you don't love me. I'd say, yes, I do, but there's nothing I can do about it. I said, worry does not have a positive effect upon me. Worry only weakens my prayers. I said, if I'm going to pray about it and then have to worry about it, obviously I need another higher power. Mine ain't good enough. Because if I've given it to him, I ought to be able to leave it alone with him if I trust him. So the problem is never that. It's always me. When I have inner peace, my circumstances are not important. I can put a God bubble around me. Do y'all know about God bubbles? When I'm going into situations that I feel a little fearful or what have you about, I ask God to put a bubble of protection around me and that let those things, those harmful things that other people would say, hit that and bounce off and not have to penetrate my heart and not have to hurt me. And on the other hand, also let anything that I'd have a tendency to do to retaliate bounce off that and come back so that I don't hurt anybody else either. And I did that for years going around my mother and certain people that I had a tendency to have negative reactions to when I was around them. Or if you're in a fearful situation of any kind, you can ask God to put that bubble of protection, and that'll give you a lot of peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. Well, you know, we're talking about the past, but see, the difference between the past and experience is that we have learned from going through the past. You know, experience is the wisdom that you have to share. You know, I've done this and this is what worked. That's my experience. I've done this and this didn't work. That was my experience. Maybe your experience may be different, but mine is mine. It's uniquely mine because nobody else has lived every day of their life like I have. And be grateful. Experience is what bridges the gap between us. And the reason I say that, I went for a long time to Al-Anon meetings, and I heard in the early years in the meetings there was a lot of griping and complaining about the alcoholic. I'll be honest about it, there was. And thank God we don't do that in our group. We focus on solutions, not problems. But I can remember, like say, going to those meetings, and I hear these women talking about how mean the alcoholic was to them. What a terrible thing that he did. How he did this, how he did that. And I'm thinking in the back of my mind, well, now, especially when they'd come in and say their alcoholic hit them. You know, they come in with the blue bruises or whatever, and they'd say, well, he was drunk and he did this or that or whatever. And I'd begin to feel a little uncomfortable. Because, see, nobody was talking about beating up alcoholics. And I felt a lot of shame about that. There was a program on NBC one time, and it talked about abuse. It talked about sexual abuse. It talked about emotional abuse. It talked about husband beaters. Husband beaters. I identified with that segment. It talked about wife beaters, but the part that got me was that husband beater, because, see, I thought it was okay to do that. I thought it was okay when somebody hurts you to hurt them back, and they had a label for it, and that made me feel a lot of guilt. And then all of a sudden, one night in the meeting, I heard this old woman talking, and she said, you know, when he'd come home drunk and pass out in the middle of the floor, I'd take a baseball bat, and I'd work his ass over. And I thought, I like her. But what she did when she shared that experience was she gave me permission to take the secret out of the closet and share it where it didn't have to eat my lunch anymore. And I found that no one appreciates abuse on men better than a group of Al-Anons. I mean, no one appreciates that as much. You know, it was amazing to me. It was just amazing to me that I could take that stuff out. And when people say we understand, they meant it. We understand because we've been there. We've had that experience too. There's that shared experience. And we can tell people, you know, I felt that way too. But I don't have to feel that way today. I have a choice. And then they're interested and they want to know. So that's the best thing about the experience. No matter what you've done, no matter how far you've gone down, there's somebody else who has done that. And I was told by a girl one time, she said, you know, you haven't done one thing I haven't done or wanted to do. And with her belief system that she had, wanting to do it made you just as guilty as if you did it. She felt no more guilt than I did for having done it just by her wanting to do it. And I said, well, that may be true, but the court looks at it a little different. And she said, jail was not a location. It was a state of mind. She said, you know, and I found that to be because I've known people who have been in prison for a number of years, and they said they were just as free in prison as they have ever been on the street because they were free in their heart and soul, that they had worked through their problems. So the walls of a prison, walls do not a prison make. It's an attitude. It's an attitude, and I had those bars and those walls up around myself to protect me because I was scared to death that you were going to find out what I had done, that you were going to find out that I had physically abused my husband, that you'd find out that I had been to jail, that you would find out I hated my mother. I had all those secrets that I was so afraid of. But those were the things, when I began to share those things, I felt you had those same kind of feelings too. Whether you'd acted them out, you had still thought them and felt them. You know, it's real funny, you know, I dreamed about killing J.D. for a long time. I never planned his funeral. I guess I wasn't going to bury him. I don't guess. I guess I just... You know, throw him in a browning bag, you know, save him for supper. I don't know. I'd hear so many women in the meeting talking about how they planned his funeral and they knew what they were going to wear, and they'd go past the coffin and they'd have this dialogue and they'd go, ha, 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 and stuff like that. And I'm thinking, how sick. They're just planning the funeral, you know. Me, I plan to kill him. I don't plan no funeral. I mean, you know, dispose the body and go on. But that was my experience. But I could relate to those feelings of frustration that get you to that point that you want out of a situation. And the funny thing about this is, those experiences in our lives, when we let God use them, become that mysterious preparation for the work He's going to do with you. Everything that's happened to you has happened so that you can take that experience and help someone else. It is the most amazing thing. You know, that's just like the girls that have been pregnant and had the abortions. When they share that, that gives the other girls who have felt so much guilt about that the freedom to share that. Or the guy who's had children and walked away and never saw them again. When they share that, that gives the person who has that guilt feeling the freedom to share that. It's a wonderful thing. Because you identify with people, and that takes away the aloneness. You know, we all feel so isolated. We all feel so alone on the inside. And when we begin to share those feelings, we find out that we are not alone and that in God's hands, our past becomes one of our greatest assets. I just love that. You know, one time I was talking in Bellevue, Nebraska, and I was doing a weekend on the steps, and I was sharing about the planning of an affair that I had had in my mind, and this was after being in the program about 4 or 5 years, that I had this idea that I was... getting old and that this guy was attractive, and I began to justify and rationalize all that same kind of thinking I had done years and years before that I thought I was immune to because I was in the program, and how much guilt I felt about that, and how I, when I'd call my sponsor, I'd tell her there's something I need for you to pray for me about, but I wouldn't tell her what it was, and how the feeling didn't go away until I identified it, named it, and claimed it, and told her what it was, and then she asked me just to pray and ask God to relieve me the need to do that. To take that need for me to do that away before I ruined my marriage. Because, I mean, this was the man that I never screwed around on when we're in all of our years together. And then here sober and me in a program and we're contemplating something, you know. It's real sick. Just shows you that you can be in the program and be sick and do sick things. Just because you're here doesn't mean you turn instantly well overnight. And I had gotten sort of cocky in the program. And, you know, I've got this thing whipped and I know how to do this thing. And, oh, my God, here's an old behavior from the past coming up to haunt me. And I thought to myself, why am I sharing this on a tape my husband might hear? Not good, not good. And then I went on to tell him that I didn't have to act on that because God removed from me the need to have to do that. And I went all the way through that little deal, and I kept thinking, it's one of those that once you get started, you know, you can't stop till you take it through, and you're going, I wish I hadn't ever brought this one up, and it's on tape. I can't believe I'm doing this. There was a girl that came up to me afterwards, and she said, I'm so glad you talked about that. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, that she had a flair for her minister who was doing some counseling with her, and that she was attracted to him, and she had been having those same kind of thoughts, and she said that he didn't seem to be getting away from that either. And she said, I have a feeling that we're going to be acting on that, but I don't think I'm going to have to now because I know what to do. I've got to tell somebody. And she said, I've been in the program a long time, and I was ashamed to have to tell somebody I was having these kind of feelings after being in the program a long time. And so then I knew why I'd had to share what I shared that weekend. So God took that past of mine and put it to some use for her, and it really helped me. And that's like all that crud from the past about my mother. That has been some of the greatest tools in sharing with other people to help them to work through those things with their parents. Okay, that feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. You ever thought about it? Self-pity is such a respectable defect of character. It's so logical and it's so convincing, and your suffering can be just so terrible and you can just wallow in it. It can bring you gloom and doom and despair. It can make you sick, you know. You can get depressed. You can get suicidal. Self-pity is the only prison that binds your soul. Do you know that? And it is a soul sickness, and it's one of the hardest things to get rid of. It is absolutely one of the most difficult defects, because we get such mileage out of feeling sorry for ourselves. And people that I sponsor that come to me with that self-pity, you know, and they say, "You don't have any pity for me at all. You don't have any compassion." And I say, "Honey, you're doing such a good job for yourself, ain't nothing I could do come anywhere close to touching that. You're doing it for yourself, and you're doing such a good job, you know." But dissatisfaction, the things that make us feel sorry for ourselves, why do we do that? I think a lot of times we feel sorry for ourselves because we have a distorted view of what other people are doing and their happiness. And we see ourselves as not having what we think we ought to have or what we want. And that's because we have a tendency to judge other people. We look at their outsides and judge them by our insides. And if their outsides don't feel like our insides, then we feel sorry for us. How come I'm the only one that has to have... How come Chris can eat everything she wants and be skinny? How can she do that? Why can't I eat everything that she eats? God, when I eat that Brahms, I just might as well rub it on my butt to start with. You know... You know, why does that happen? God, that's sad, ain't it? That is sad. You mean, how long do I have to be on this diet? The rest of your life. That's not fair. You know, that's some of that crap self-pity. And we judge our conditions, and what happens to me is every time I make comparison or start judging me against you, I'm screwed up. Because I never come out equal to anybody. You're either better than or you're less than. When have you ever judged anything and come out equal to? Why, I'm just like that person. You never say that. You say that to your spouse. You're just like your mother. You're just like your ratty brother. You know, and when people judge you like that, do they ever judge you against something good? Honey, you're just like Liz Taylor. You're gorgeous. You're a diamond in the rough. No, they don't say stuff like that to me. You know. But what happens in that judging is that it isolates you because it makes you different. It makes you different. It makes you feel sorry for yourself. You know, years may wrinkle your skin, but enthusiasm and loss of joy wrinkles your soul. You know, you just get it on the inside when you do all that. That self-pity is a real good friend of worry and distrust and fear and despair. And all those things just crush your spirit, just absolutely crush your spirit.